you know, whose facility it is, and, you know, you establish this facility, and people come by and dump their stuff in, and then who takes care of the stuff?
It'll be part, Madam Chair and Senator Frank, it'll be part of the, in any community that it resides, it will be the community's facility, except in those instances where a private corporation or company is collecting waste, then it may be a part of that facility. In some instances, they're mobile.
So in Fairbanks, it's probably the borough's solid waste facility?
I believe so, but I'm not certain.
We can get you that information.
And then what kind of waste are we talking about here?
We're talking really about household hazardous waste.
Paints and...
And some other exempt hazardous waste. If it was a industry of some type, then it's an industrial hazardous waste and then must be treated differently. But the problem with household hazardous waste and some other exempt waste, since it is exempt, it can be just dumped into the landfills. And ultimately, though, these chickens will come home to roost. So what we're trying to do is get this before that becomes a problem.
So if I, if you don't mind me following up on that, well, I'm just wondering what they do if you get all these different kinds of household waste, and the ones that come to my mind would be something like paints or something like that. I don't know what these things are.
These have to be drummed and then chipped out.
So they mix all this stuff, all this different kinds of waste together, and then they put it in drums, and then they ship it out to some facility?
Right. Each drum has to be labeled as to its content, and they try to keep paint, for example, separate from caustic sodas and so forth. And then these have to be drummed, labeled, and then sent to an approved hazardous waste facility, which we do not yet have in Alaska.
So in the case of the Fairbanks situation, I hate to belabor, but I'm just trying to understand. I mean, what role does DEC have in this, I guess is my question. I mean, I understand that there's these federal regs and you have regs on hazardous waste, and that the borough would be interested in not having its landfill be contaminated with all these hazardous wastes that aren't, you know, industrial. But why does the department, what is the department's role in establishing this facility?
The department's role is to be certain that the wastes themselves, when collected and congregated, are properly handled in accordance with regulations.
So how is that different than any of your other operating budget responsibilities to make sure that everybody follows the laws?
In this instance, Senator Frank, I guess we're getting we're moving into an area that, for the first time, because these were exempt materials and typically simply dumped into landfills. So.
Would these be grants to the communities that have the responsibility to take care of the hazardous?
Yes, and it only does a part, it only covers a part of the cost. And the communities themselves are really putting in much more than this typically to collect these materials.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Sharp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to, I've had a person approach me several times the last year on waste motor oil. He's in the business, but wondering if, and I'll ask you, has the department ever give a permit or a license or whatever to a commercial enterprise to set up a collection station for the do-it-yourselfers that usually pour it down the drain or pour it, which I understand is 40 to 60% of the waste oil is from privately owned motor vehicles ends up somewhere besides where it's supposed to be.
Yes.
Have you ever licensed anyone or someone to permit to where they can collect that motor oil without the liability of guaranteeing what's in the motor oil?
Well, that last caveat is an interesting thing because you never know, particularly where, as in boat harbors or whatever else, there typically are places which are certified as waste used oil. You don't know what someone might dump in there, but this material is collected, it is drummed, it is labeled, then it's tested later, not by us typically, but... but in answer to your question, Senator, yes, there are these facilities. They are certified as such collection points, and they are intended to avoid just precisely the point you make, and it's encouraged that the private sector do this. And in fact, you'll often see a service station that will in fact advertise that as a for that purpose.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's move on to the next one.
The next item is a laboratory operations instrument acquisition and installation of new equipment needed to meet EPA and OSHA requirements. This item stems from requirements of the Environmental Protection Agency, and particularly to deal with regulated substances. The Safe Drinking Water Act requires that the state, if it's to retain primacy, have the ability to detect and measure these toxic substances. And this new equipment that is covered in this particular capital budget item is needed to meet both the Environmental Protection Agency and the Occupational Safety and Health Agency of regulatory requirements. That, in a nutshell, is what this is involved. In our document itself, lists the very specific items and instruments. And these are instruments that we did not have the capability of doing. They're listed actually in priority order. I do not understand the chemistry of this thing adequately to explain what an ion chromatograph is. Also a solid waste, a solid phase extraction apparatus, a handheld radiation detector, a liquid scintillation counter, and some lead shielding that goes into this thing.
This request was decreased by the governor to $120,000. Which of the equipment would you purchase with that $120,000 of the...
Those items that I just mentioned are the ones that are on our priority listing. I do not have the listing, Madam Chair, beyond that. I'll have to supply you with the...
Looks like they went down to priorities, probably 1, 2, and 3. Okay. And the satellite data?
The satellite data...
I'm sorry, Commissioner.
Excuse me.
Senator Sharp?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just a question on that. A couple of years ago, when the Safe Water Act came into being, and the requirement that all community water supplies and public water supplies be tested to meet those new standards, I know a lot of several private labs geared up because they assumed they were going to be called upon to do some of that work, but in fact, most of it was done by the state lab. And I'm wondering if private enterprise can perform the same duty and be certified by the DEC rather than the DEC continuing to expand the lab and the equipment for that. Now, I know I'm sure you recall there was quite a controversy on that, and I think the price was something like $250 to $500 a test or something commercially, but the state provided the first two or three tests for every supply, source of supply. Through their lab, which resulted in bypassing utilization of private enterprise labs that could have done the job. So I'm real leery when I see new equipment being proposed to do similar type work, if in fact the DEC can certify private labs to do it.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharp, your point's well taken, and we did have a controversy described, particularly as we did the laboratory testing for the rural communities that could have been done by the private sector, but at the differential cost that you pointed out. And we have ceased that effort and gone back now to see if, in fact, we can get these individuals to that is, if we can get individual communities to utilize the private lands. I should say that the equipment that we are ordering in this laboratory upgrade is in fact needed to also certify private lands. And we will encourage and do encourage the use of private lands. So part of this is to enable us to do the certification of private lands.
Thank you very much. Now on to the satellite telemetry.
Madam Chair, a year ago, I guess it was 2 years ago, when I first appeared here, shortly after I became commissioner, I learned that of the United States and territories, 54, I guess, total, Alaska was 53rd in meeting the water monitoring and testing requirements in the state. And partly this was because our rural communities simply weren't doing the test. And as Senator Sharp pointed out, we made a major emphasis to try to do tests of rural communities and even funded them and did them ourselves. This satellite data telemetry development is actually a first step in doing automated water monitoring at remote sites, and really offers great promise. We believe it's possible, particularly after having been briefed by the Department of Defense, General McInerney and his staff, it's possible to, by telemetry, to in fact collect, gather, and monitor on the ground and transmit by satellite information that in fact has to be collected in order for us to maintain the primacy, in fact in order for us to assure that the systems are safe. I would like to just use as an illustration of the desirability of remote kind of control. Keith, could you, in that example of you and Greg were fighting the other day, identify how a $40,000 investment saved a problem that occurred because someone drained out the fuel from a water system?
Madam Chairman, member of the committee, the project that we work on primarily Village Safe Water System in remote areas. One of the projects we're working on is a NOAA-TAC right now. This project had a history of failure 5 years ago when it froze up. We've been working with the community to try to improve their operational capabilities. But as a safeguard of the state's capital budget expenditure there, in this project we established some remote sensing capabilities at about $35,000 to $40,000. We are capable of, through a dedicated telephone line, monitoring this project from Anchorage from a computer screen. This just went online this winter, and fortunate it did, because one of the very first cold weather spells, when apparently it was unable to get enough supplies in the community, somebody decided they wanted the fuel out of the state tank, which is keeping the facility boiler operating, so they siphoned it. We were able to tell from Anchorage, as soon as the boiler went off and the heat started to drop, and we were able to call up an operator in NOAA-TAC and get fuel back into the tank and save a $500,000 building from being destroyed. So what the commissioner is saying is the satellite system has more flexibility and more potential and could eliminate the need for the dedicated telephone lines. But we envision this as a possibility of all new construction going in of having this remote sensing and thereby protecting state investments.
I just use that as an illustration. Anyway, I think this does offer great promises. And this is the first step is actually to establish a ground station to try to get this system started. And is the capital investment required to do that? So are there any questions regarding the Madam Chair?
I don't believe so.
Chairperson?
Yes, sir. Senator Katerina?
I find it incredible, because it's a pretty sophisticated committee that you couldn't have some management right there to do its own continuous checking. It's amazing. But I understand what you're doing. It's partly an experiment that could be done, too. Thank goodness it was. But still, I find it crap. It's very responsible people.
In this case, Senator Curtula, the operator had checked the facility just that morning. It was operating properly. He was unaware, and when it happened that someone was siphoning fuel out of that tank, there was no lack of operational skills and by the part of the community, but having this as a backup did save the facility.
That's great.
Well, that includes the actual items in Department of Environmental Conservation budget. I did, at your request, the Madam Chair, identify two additional projects, $1.5 million for the response fund support for the Alaska Marine Highway System ferry, and this is with the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. This ferry is to be outfitted with response command facilities, mobile emergency response depot, and serve as berthing and cargo.
Mr. Commissioner, the projects that are allocating, in this case, the major projects allocating 470 funds, we're going to do a full committee hearing on 470 funds themselves for the front section of the budget, and I would rather wait for that time because the bells have rung. I know there are questions on that particular project, and no reason to start them and not be able to finish them.
Thank you.
Does anyone have any other questions for the Commissioner, though, on the projects that he has gone through? Okay. Just so that the committee will know, next week, starting Monday morning, we have our final overviews on education and revenue. Then Tuesday morning, the university. They did have to cancel because of the weather. Wednesday morning, we begin at 8 because we have bills. And then from 9 to 11, we have the Alaska Railroad. Thursday morning, we're having an economic overview by the Department of Labor. So we will be meeting every day next week. And with that, we're adjourned. The finance will come to order. It is February 9th, 1993, 9 a.m. Present are Senators Pierce, Frank, Sharp, Kelly, Rieger, and Curtula. We have today the University of Alaska Capital Budget Overview. Unfortunately, the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities Central Region Overview will have to be rescheduled. The schedule of the Central Region people and our people didn't work. We have Dr. Komisar and Marcia Hubbard, but first, if we could, Senator Kelly, if you could make the motion, please, on the Cambridge Energy contract.
Madam Chair, I would move to authorize the Director of Legislative Finance Division to enter into a sole source contract with Cambridge Energy Research Associates for oil price forecasting services on behalf of the House and Senate Finance Committees to exceed $17,500.
How much?
$17,500.
One more time?
$17,500. I offered to do it for $3,000.
We have a motion.
That's coming on cold. So.
Have a motion on the table. Senator Curtula, the House has agreed to share that cost with us, so it should only be half that for the Senate. We're also asking for a 10% reduction in the price. We'll see if we can get it. So we do have a motion on the table.
I have a question,
Senator Curtula.
What are they going to do?
There is a memo which you may not have read.
No, I haven't
seen yesterday.
I haven't had a chance to.
Okay. We'll become, go back on as the World Oil retainer clients. We'll receive the quarterly World Oil Watch, the oil reports and fax alerts, 2 seats at the conferences, which we probably won't use, but the regular phone access to the yearly conference call. The Cambridge people will not be attempting to make a trip to Juneau as they have so often been unsuccessful in doing over the past few years.
So they're going to give us, are they going to give us a market basket and an estimated oil price? Is that what it is?
Yes, they will.
And
they will be on retainer.
By a teleconference?
Yes. They will be on retainer for the year.
Till last year, they didn't do a good job of it. Last year, they brought it back to the Alaskan scene. The value to us was that the administration had a political
agenda and would always underestimate the price with that agenda. These people were very straight. They give it to you the way they see it. And they were right on, so the Senate's forecast last year and the year before were the ones both the House and the Senate used, the administration found to be conservative. If they do that because of the politics of this, unfortunately, of the legislature versus the administration, it's worthwhile. They did a good job on it. Is this, I do say one thing more because I think in the minority I have that responsibility. Last several years we sent Senator Euling on a conference to Houston, and I was never sure we got much out of that conference, so I'm rather hopeful that this doesn't provide some junketing around for no purpose for members of this committee. And we didn't prevent anybody from going previously, but it's one of those things I doubted the value of. Thank you.
When I served on Senate Finance 4 years ago, I went to one of those conferences. I did not find it that useful myself, so I never returned to another one. We will have access to those conferences. I don't know, frankly, if they're always in Houston. I don't have any idea. Senator Frank and I would look at any requests from any members, but I suspect we would not look at them favorably.
Well, at least they should have a reasonable report, Chairperson, that literally shows that something of value occurred there for us, or at least they could be innovative, but we never got anything I could tell, except we did get last year in particular a very good report out of the people that were here that gave us the foundations of substance to base the budget on. And I think that's real important to us. I don't have any objection.
Any other discussion on the motion? Okay. All those in favor, please say aye. Raise your
right hand.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Budget Finance is directed to go forward with the Cambridge contract. Thank you, Dr. Komisar, for being patient with us, and please proceed.
Madam Chair, it's a pleasure to be here with the committee to talk about the capital budget request of the university. I will, my comments will be very brief, and I will be pleased to respond to any and all questions. Those that I don't have an answer for, we will go back and get an answer to you. The capital budget request of the university was divided into a number of parts. The first two were requests for funds to respond to what would be legal requirements. The first was repairs that we needed in order to bring our buildings and structures into code compliance. We have a number of buildings that have seen a lot of time, seen some wear and tear, that need changes just for life safety reasons. All of those are located on the Fairbanks campus, and we requested in our original budget somewhat over $6 million for code compliance. The second category was again a response to law, and that was to the federal American Disabilities compliance needs. And we requested $5 million for that. Our feeling is that $5 million is about half of what we will need to bring our buildings into compliance with the federal legislation. A third element of our budget request was not a legal requirement, but it was clearly a requirement to work against the damages of the past and once again the ravages of time and abuse. And that was a $33 million, close to $34 million request for deferred maintenance. It's part of a 5-year plan to pick up the physical plant of the university and bring it up to the standards that I think would be much more acceptable to the people of Alaska. The fourth element, again, was something where we had very little freedom of choice, and that was building completions. We have a number of buildings in the system that have been under construction or are incomplete for use. And we requested somewhat over $24 million for building completions. Those included space in Anchorage and Matsu, in the system office in Fairbanks, in Southeast, and then the natural sciences completion in Fairbanks and a greenhouse in Fairbanks. We also had, as our fifth item, an equipment. One of the things we have discovered, not only in the University of Alaska, but throughout higher education, is the need to maintain and bring the equipment we have for teaching and for research up to the standards of the discipline. And that has become a greater and greater priority within the university, as we have not been able to fill this particular gap for a number of years. You'll notice, if you have the list in front of you, that the first item on that list, which would be E12, is for the Anchorage campus, and that is to equip the campus with a fiber optic backbone so that you can develop communications across the campus from computer to computer. This would tie in the faculty and the students and allow for a level of communication that is now a standard at universities and at colleges. When I first entered the academy, the term fiber optics wasn't even known, and now it has become a necessity. The fifth item is construction for growth, and these are the most immediate needs that we see in terms of meeting what is a growing demand on the part of the population for service from the university. The first item, which is to complete an aviation technology building, it actually is to add to an existing structure. That's a matching fund. We have received close to $7 million of federal funds through the FAA to work on, to build such a complex. And this is asking for a state match. It's a vocational and technical program that has a great deal of appeal to students in the state. There is an immediate and very large job market available to the successful graduates of the program. The program now has an extensive queue. Most of the classes, if not all of them, have a waiting list. This would allow us to expand the facility. It's a facility-bound program, and this would allow us to progress in an industry that is quite important to the state of Alaska. You then have an upgrade in the Anchorage Science Building, some land acquisition, and an addition to the campus at Bristol Bay at Dillingham. We then have a whole section that is planning for growth, and that is looking at projects that we expect to, that we know we will need, and that we want to begin a detailed study of immediately. The total came to $107 million, somewhat more than $19 million that's in the governor's budget. Part of the difference is that the deferred maintenance request is being considered for bonding rather than through appropriation. So we have removed from this list the $33 million for deferred maintenance, with the prospect that we would be able to push forward on that program, which is a very critical program, through a bonding process.
Madam Chair.
Senator Kelly.
How would the bonding process work?
This would be an AHC, the Alaska Housing Authority.
Where do they get authorization to bond for the university for maintenance?
They would, it would be an act of the legislature that would give them the authorization. It could not move without an act of the legislature, as I understand.
Senator Petula? All right, Senator Kelly, do you have a follow-up?
It just occurs to me, the AHC, do we pay that then annually, or does AHC absorb it and add it into their system? They have some money on hand. Is this a method of providing for some of that surplus to get into some more meaningful production here? How is this possible?
There would be an alternative there. One would be that the legislature would appropriate year to year to pay the bonds. The other is that AHC could use some of its income to pay those bonds. So there is a decision to be made there. I don't think there is any prescribed.
Legislation to be presented by the administration, and I understand it is, in the way in the back.
Yes.
Are they going to go both ways in it, or have the decision not been made?
I'm not sure if the decision's been made.
I'd like to see backup, and I suspect the committee would do, for the point that AHSC could pay this bond, or some substantial portion of it. I'd kind of like to see that mechanism, if I can get that, and any backup that you might have suggest that. I don't mind doing this, except I don't want to backdoor AHFC with all kinds of great ideas, and this would be one of many. So that's my concern. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bain, did you have a question? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Sorry.
I just had one last comment. What is not on this list is are some self-help approaches to the problems, to the capital needs of the university. We did purchase a building in Anchorage this year that will greatly aid that campus, which is under enormous pressure for space. And we are looking at creative ways of getting some of the capital structures, the physical structures, put up on the campus. One is a hope to be able to put up a research facility on Fairbanks that would be paid for through some indirect cost recovery due to the federal contracts that we feel we will attract because we have the additional facility, as well as house some federal agencies that very much want to move on the campus so that their scientists will be working adjacent to our scientists and to our graduate students. We have also been giving some consideration in terms of additional dormitory space to trying to tie in with the hotel industry. Can you develop a balance where something constructed for use by tourists in the summer would be available to students during the academic year?
Have you talked to the railroad?
Good idea. Chairperson,
Senator Cadu.
The student cooperative hotel system with some subsidy in construction might be a possibility, like, as you know, your Scandinavians do. But we, of course, always intended to make this a Tramway Tech, kind of like USC used to be, where you came in out of the community and provided your own housing, and those that didn't went to Fairbanks. Of course, every plan changes in a decade. I'm told, though, that there's quite a bit of history of community college style and so on in the Anchorage campus, and I think Fairbanks, too, has some of this problem, in that you don't utilize your weekends. Friday to some extent, Saturday, Sunday are just not used, but your buildings aren't being used, and there's a whole group of students that do pattern and fit themselves into weekend campus attendance, upgrading themselves going to college. And I think we can pretty well establish from 2 years that I previously was chairman of this committee looking into it, that you have a very low use of your facilities on weekends, hence you need probably more buildings because of that than you might need if you could kick your administrators into shape and get that weekend use. And I know they all think they're separate empires, but I'm very supportive of the university and have always been, but I think that is a legitimate question, particularly on the Anchorage campus, which has a history of doing an awful lot of work with part-time students. But the other campus is probably true, too. Some of those buildings ought to be better used on weekends as well, and a whole academic program built around it. I'm just throwing that out there to be controversial, perhaps, but I think it's of concern to us that no student go unhoused insofar as construction goes, and how in these times of reduced budgets we can provide for them. So you may well be on top of that. You may have a plan that's going to produce. But again, we're going to produce $100 and some million, and frankly, I'm very much for the program. But still, there's some, including one side of myself, that says if you can better produce and utilize these facilities, we ought to do part of this with weekend use of them.
I agree that we have to press further to get higher utilization of the space. And I think that has been what has been occurring over the last couple of years, that there has been a greater utilization of the space. Most of the new space that we're asking for is going to be rather specialized space. And that's one of the areas where you know, the use itself, the increasing usage, doesn't really help if you don't have the space.
No, I can understand scientific laboratories and so on that you may not have now.
On the Anchorage area, what we need is scientific space and library space, and those are two things where it isn't just the hours, it really is just the lack of facilities. The Fairbanks campus right now, we're trying to complete out more science space and finish that construction, and then we will need more research space as the research capacity and energy of that campus increases.
chairperson to follow one
more.
But is it not true that we're not getting a very good response to suggestions? Probably as high up as your office. And, you know, legislature very uneasily gets involved here because you're a completely separate branch from the Constitution, except we have to pay the bill. But you, I don't think you're getting a good response in regard to utilization of space for the weekends. I think the Juneau campus, I don't know what it's doing, but, you know, it doesn't have a very large population with quite a lot of investment either, so I'm doing okay all over the place. But,
I think you'd be right when you're talking about the weekend use. I think we have greater and greater use during the 5 days of the week. There are a lot of things that move against weekend use, and part of it is just the population that wants to do other things on Saturday and Sunday.
Still, if you want to go to school and you provide that option, you wouldn't crowd up your campus during the week for the part-timers. That's when the courses are offered. And they got a choice of going skiing or going to school. Thank you.
You're welcome. Questions? Senator Rieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions that come to mind. One of them, I know we're talking about the capital budget here, but I'd appreciate knowing how much of the operating budget request for fiscal year 94 is for maintenance campus-wide.
The method of putting the operating budget together should allow for that.
It's shown in the red book by line, and I'll
provide
it to you.
Okay, or you can just show me where I can find it. Right? I'd appreciate that. This second is, on this first capital request, could you explain, you know, what led to the June 17th, 1991 fire marshal inspection?
I think there is a routine process of fire marshals inspecting the campuses, and I don't think that was the initial inspection that raised questions. I think there were questions from prior inspections as well. So I don't know why that date would have any particular significance.
The same report is cited. Well, no, I take that back. There are different dates of reports, but there's $6 million being asked for here, resulting from 1991 fire marshal inspection, and I don't know if these are critical. I haven't read each one to know, but it's conceivable to me that these are things which are not in compliance with the state of the 1993 code or the 1991 code at that time, that really aren't, you know, things that are immediately putting students and administrators in danger. And I just wonder if this is the best place to pour $6 million.
I can get you some more background material on that, but when I first arrived at the university, there had been ongoing discussions and negotiations with the fire marshal. And indeed, when we were first reviewed, that the dollar figure came up to be a much higher dollar figure than that. And we have negotiated what we think are the most critical aspects. And we have been staying with that.
So, I mean, the large animal research station, I saw it in the backup here, part of it was a fence that wasn't, the fencing is deficient in structural strength and layout. I mean, is that one of the most critical things facing the university, that we should put $617,000 into fencing around?
Only if you don't, if you want to keep the large animals within the fence rather than have them outside. I mean, that became one of the issues, is simply being able to hold on to these
what are
large
your
animals. Muskox and caribou. Need a strong fence for these muskox.
Senator Frank, on that point?
Yeah, on that point. I have a concern about this, have had for a lot of different budgets, not just the university. It seems like we're always reacting to a fire marshal order, and I don't know who that state fire marshal is, or I assume we pass laws that say that we are adopting the 1987 fire code, and then the fire marshal goes out and tries to enforce it. And I'm not sure that everything makes that much sense in there.
I don't blame the agencies for trying to comply with the fire marshal order, compliance order, but I think it would be helpful to have a hearing with the fire marshal to gain a better understanding of why buildings need to be brought up to code when they were built to code in the first place and that sort of thing, and to see if there aren't some ways of altering the fire code within responsible bounds so that we wouldn't have to unnecessarily spend money where it wasn't a true life-threatening or dangerous situation. And that's, you know, real easy to talk about, probably hard to accomplish, but I think it'd be worth a try for myself.
Senator Rieger.
I really agree with that. I don't know if it's what the schedule allows, but it might be good to consider inviting the fire marshal and find out just what the story is of why we're having so many code compliance requests for things that, you know, are adding up to tens of millions of dollars.
Do we really want to let him in this room?
Well, maybe not.
It costs $1 million before he leaves.
Well, that's a good, we could go down to his office.
Yeah.
This nameless, faceless individual.
That's all I have.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Kutula.
Follow up on Senator Rieger. I was thinking there in the corner following his train. Maybe we also ought to see what minimum compliance we can put, but staged in, but what minimum compliance we have to do to the access program too. I've seen some things that were ridiculous just in my hometown, so they're overdoing that in some cases. You know, if you have an elevator that's specially installed and then all of a sudden you've got to put bathrooms on the same floor because of access, and here you just got through building a very expensive elevator. It don't quite make sense to me, you know. I have that in a building once, so it was brought to my attention, for instance. So I suspect there's some things that we ought to find out about that. If we're going to go in to the fire marshal, we ought to do that one too, before we see what makes sense and what doesn't, in short.
Other questions? I have a question about your capital requests, just in the way that they were put together. How are the requests? What's the technical process that you go through to come up with these numbers in terms of fencing costing $617,000? How does that process work? Who does these for you? I assume it's not DotCuff, but who is it?
We have a construction office that prices all of these requests. We'll scrutinize and work on them. And this is an office that consists of people who are involved in construction and engineers. So that the pricing is, their estimates are normally quite good. They're then checked, of course, when we go out to bid by the fact that you have a competitive process and a bidding arrangement. But we have an office that does scrutinize the requests from the campuses and work with them to get the price, get a price value.
Okay. And I've forgotten, are you party to the discussions with DotCuff about moving facilities over under an executive order into a new division of facilities management? Is the university involved in that? There are lots of
heads shaking. The university, I think, has been invited to participate in the discussions. I think it's important for the university to continue to maintain its own facilities and work and build its own facilities. I mean, it's something that we have done with care and have done well.
Any other specific questions or non-specific questions? A quiet group this morning. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. I just want to make one comment
on the code compliance,
and that is that all the questions that the senators have raised were raised by the Board of Regents, who had the same reaction to seeing these dollar code figures in code compliance. I think perhaps the thing to do is to visit with the fire.
Senator Frank.
I'm just trying to look at the governor's request here and compare it to the capital request that was handed out. I don't know if you guys handed this out or aware of how this arrived on my case. It came out of the window. Okay. I assume that the site assessment and cleanup at the Fairbanks campus and the Nature Conservancy at Anchorage and everything is in the Red Book. I was just trying to compare it to this, and I didn't find those right on the cover page. Maybe you can help us with that. It's probably there. But...
The Nature Conservancy was a governor's addition. The UAF contaminated site we submit is not covered in the Red Book, and it's one of those situations where we submit to DEC a request, a capital request, a notification of a site cleanup that is needed, and then they budget it. In this particular case, the governor then decided to budget it in, to place the money in our budget and not in DEC's budget.
And the other funds?
They're 470 funds.
470.
And it's for cleaning up at part of our equipment yard at the fiscal plant from a benzene and chlorinated solvent issue. This money is to do the assessment. They figure, or DEC is figuring that it would take around $2 million to clean up the site, but they have to make some decisions about whether they can contain it or clean it up, and that's what the money is for.
Madam Chair?
475.
Who told your employees to pour benzene on the ground?
I don't believe anybody told anyone to put benzene on the ground. It's a matter of, this was the equipment yard, and over 20 to 30 years of trucks and other heavy equipment sitting on the yard, you have leaks and you have spills.
Senator Frank?
Did we wind up with some benzene in our in the wells there?
That, they assumed, that was from the cooling plant water, and they assume, they think, that that benzene is from a gas station that is off Geist Road.
So this site,
this site is
separate?
Yes, this is a completely different issue. This is one that is affecting all the large equipment owners in every place in the country right now. Anybody who is running any kind of shop or yards or dumps.
Can I follow up? Could we go right down the list there on the governor's bill and fill in the other blanks, not blanks, but the University of Alaska Anchorage classroom improvements remodeling? Is that covered in the red book?
Yes, sir. That is D6.
The red book, right? The request is $2,200,000.
Senator, we're about so it's covered right here.
Thank you.
Is that that one? Page 79.
Page 79, okay.
The only items on this sheet of paper that you have in front of you, Senator Frank, that are not covered in the Red Book are the two items that you brought up,
okay.
The Nature Conservancy and the DEC cleanup.
Okay. Just ask one more question on the source of funds, the other funds on the Aviation Technology Center.
That's federal funds from the FAA.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Minister.
In the Anchorage, University of Alaska Anchorage classroom improvements remodeling, the original request had been for $2.2 million. The governor reduced that to $1.2 million. What will you not be able to do in that project with the $1 million less?
My sense is that we will not be able to transform all the vacated space. That will only be able to handle a portion of it.
But you will be able to go ahead and do?
Be able to do something to increase the number of classrooms.
Could we get and I know this is asking you to make decisions kind of ahead, but can we get a memo from you talking about what you could do with $1.2 million?
Be pleased
yes.
to do that.
We have 5 buildings proposed under the $2.2 million, and we'll provide you a list of the renovations that will occur.
Senator Regan and then Senator Sharp?
Different subject. What is the university's policy for procurement of computers, small computers?
We go out to a general bid, and we can provide those to you.
Do you spec them? Do you decide that everybody's going to use Apples or IBM 386s?
No, that varies. I think within the administrative structure, you're going to have a single type of machine so that there is transferability of work, so that within the system office, we're all on Macintosh. When you go over to the academic side, you can have variation in the types of PCs that are available. So we will have a lab of Hewlett-Packard, and then one that has equipment, and others that have Macintosh. Very often it's done, you know, price bidding, but sometimes you just will have a private vendor that will come forth and say that we'll need to make a major contribution of equipment if you put up some of their a lab that uses their equipment.
Is that why you're about the only agency in the state that hasn't asked for computer equipment?
We have some computer equipment in there. I must say that more important than the computer equipment right now is that fiber optic right on the computer. But I must say we have a major...
Buried under matching funds. Or is it home land acquisition?
You see, I'll tell you when we hit there.
One more word and I'll know where
on that point, the fiber optics request was reduced from $1,000,003 to $530,000. Could you also do a memo saying what you can do with $530,000?
Yes.
Whether it's worth
we're
going
to build three central hubs, but I'll get it in a memo to you.
Senator Sharp.
Thank you, Minister. Could you clarify a little bit between the two pieces of these two schedules? One, capital request, general funds, says under item F. 16, $10 million, $10,100,000 general funds. The governor's bill shows $600,000 general funds and $7,485,000 total, of which the remainder is federal funds. So, is the $10,100,000 an over? Is that an error for general funds?
No, that was our original request.
So what? So this basically is funding
just
half
planning.
Of the project?
No, what it is. We're requesting $600,000 to plan for the completion of the facilities. That does not have any construction within that $600,000. The $10,100,000 matched with the federal grant of about $6.7 would have given us both the planning and the construction fund. The $600,000 will not lead to any bricks being put down for that building.
But the $6,885,000 of other funds, which I assume is federal funds, you're asking for appropriation. So are those funds available from the federal government at this time?
Those funds will not be available until we have the matching funds to go with. Those funds depend upon being able to get a state match.
So
the building we're looking at is about a $17 million addition.
So these budget forms are actually incorrect in the federal receipts. Are not available.
We don't. We could have the authority, but they wouldn't give us the money until we get the match.
So $600,000 is planning only.
Correct. We received $300,000 last year. With this $600,000, we could be bid ready for next year, assuming that we did get a state match for the federal funds.
What is the match program? What percentage?
It's about $10 of state funds to about $7 of federal.
And you say that the expanded facility will accommodate programs presently conducted in leased space, enhancing programs presently housed within the facility, but you don't talk about any new programs. What are we spending on the leased space? Does it make sense to spend $10 for every federal dollar to replace leased space?
This not only would replace leased space, what this would do is enable us to enlarge the program. And the fact that we'd be on one location would bring us certain efficiencies of operation. But our sense is that it really is of value to do this.
Senator Frank.
I thought the governor was talking about finishing some buildings. And this looks like the start of a new building where there's several unfinished buildings around the state, if I'm hearing you correctly, we're talking about a requirement that the state put in $10 million to match the federal government $7 million, and it just seems inconsistent with what I thought his policy was this year in terms of finishing buildings.
Well, we're not The governor did not grant us the $10 million to begin construction on this. What he did do is have the $600,000 for the planning operation. So we really don't have any construction funds. In essence, he's meeting the completion principle that he's been working with. I want to go back to the importance of this particular facility. Our vocational technical programs in aeronautics are exceptionally good. We are one of, I think, two or three locations in the country where air traffic controllers, are now being trained and don't need additional training at the federal level, but can go immediately into on-the-job training in airports. I mean, this is quite an achievement, and we're talking about an industry that really is very important to the state. And maintaining a quality labor force, I think, for the airline and aeronautics industry is just a very high priority to the university.
Could we see an expanded project description and justification of this and explain what the 17 new positions would be? Because it really doesn't talk about any new positions in your narrative.
Yes.
And a discussion of the lease space cost effectiveness versus adding on to the present building at Merrill.
We'd be very happy to do that to you.
Does anyone else have a hand up? Other questions? Senator Frank.
The Regents, I assume each one of these letters with the corresponding numbers after them are prioritized. In other words, letter F, construction for growth, aviation technology is the number one priority of the university statewide. Are they also prioritized down the line here in terms of equipment being a higher priority than construction for growth and building completions being a higher priority than equipment?
This is in order of priority. It's always difficult, as you know, establishing priority that's 1, 2, 3, 4, that's a great deal of overlap, but this is as clear a priority list as you can develop.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Senator Rieger.
Just last one. On the 6.8 million to complete the Butcherich building. Was that the building that was originally appropriated in fiscal year 91? The $30 million building?
The Butcherich goes back to fiscal year 81. And I think the first major expenditure for construction itself was in 85, and then there was some more in 86, and then it sort of dribbles along. If you wanted a paradigm of how not to put up a building, I think the Butcherich would give you a perfect case history. The last year there was $3 million for the Butcherich building. That is to design, redesign, and construct the basement of that building, the lowest floor, to house the supercomputer.
Okay, if that's all for the university, we thank you very much.
I've got one comment. The unfortunate question of the supercomputer has led us to a serious problem for distribution of some significant funding controlled by the senator for Alaska rather than distribution to other campuses around the country. They just sort of reacted to all this fallout, and it's unfortunate because I think the supercomputer is going to be very valuable and asset to academia, to Alaska, and to the rest of the nation. We're just lucky to have it.
So
there's fallout from that, the next step in another project may well get distributed to other universities, unfortunately, because of that fallout. I know that could be true. I'm going farther because you know it can be true too, probably.
I have the feeling that the
we've got very provincial on that.
I have the feeling the senator's got a very bad rap on
that. He did.
And it was the press that got carried away, and the article, the major article that was written on that came out in the Washington Post. That article had a certain balance to it, but the articles that fed off it lost all balance, and I think that it's one of those cases where the media was unhelpful because it was halting a complete discussion or an accurate one.
But it has affected another project.
We haven't seen it yet, and we hope that it doesn't materialize. But it clearly is
a lot of pressure
about
understanding. Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have gone through, and I believe we have a complete list of all the CIP computer systems requests, and they total $19,533,000 that we've listened to over the past 8 or 9 days. Senator Frank and I would be interested in having a subcommittee work specifically on these, working with Office of Management and Budget, finding out all about ISPRIC and TIC, which of these programs have been through the process of approval, what that meant, if anything, so on and so forth. And Senator Rieger, we were wondering if you would be interested in chairing that subcommittee, since you've shown possibly the most interest in the technicalities. And I suspect a number of us would be interested in working with you.
That's a good choice, Madam Chair.
I think just for balance, we need Senator Kelly on there.
We've got to get
tech guy.
That's what we need. We need a low-tech guy.
I'm a low-tech guy.
Anyway, Senator Rieger, we'd like you to think of that. And Senator Kelly, for you, because you have the public safety budget and because this nameless, faceless fire marshal is in that budget, we think, we'd like you to coordinate the day that that particular division is going to be in front of your subcommittee. Senator Kelly, we don't have it. You can be on the low-tech computer committee.
You can be education.
On the day that you can have the fire marshal, that division, down for a subcommittee, if we could have them also be with us for full committee to talk through some of these code questions at the same time, just to coordinate timing, if that's possible. Tomorrow morning we have 3 bills up first. Senate Bill 30, I hear, is ready to come back to full committee. Hopefully we will move that out. House Bill 68, the Supplemental Appropriation for Elections, and this is the small supplemental. I would hope we could move tomorrow. Please look at your packets. Come to the committee with whatever questions you have. Senate Bill 47 is Senator Kelly's registration and equipment of custom cars. And then we will begin the meeting at 8. And then at 9, we will have the Alaska Railroad management and board members. The board members that we've invited are Mr. Lounsbury, chairman of the board, along with the 2 commissioners presently serving on the board, which would be Commissioner Turpin and Commissioner Foos. We've prepared a packet with just some information about some of the projects and some of the questions that's being sent around to all of your offices. You're free to add any other information about the railroad that you have, any questions you have, please be prepared to bring to the table.
Madam Chair, what was Senate Bill 30?
Minerals Commission.
Extension of the Minerals Commission.
No.
Okay. And how many of us are going to be in Anchorage for the university maintenance meetings this weekend? Okay, and myself. So there will be 4 of us. Okay, fine. We will be teleconferencing that Saturday meeting when the panel actually includes us along with Mr. Stassen to Juno. I don't know what the room is here, but we'll let your offices know so that your staff or yourselves can be with us by teleconference. Okay? Great. With that, we're adjourned.
Invite. I sound terrible. That'll be all right. we've got John Boucher and Neil Fried today with us from the Department of Labor. We thought it would be, if nothing else, very interesting to have a report on what our economy consists of and what the trends have been and are projected to be and that sort of thing. I don't know how much detail you were asked to get into or whatever, but we'll just open it up to you guys and let you do your thing.
Well, good morning. My name is John Boucher. I'm a Juneau-based labor economist for Alaska Department of Labor's Research and Analysis section. Neil Fried works in our Anchorage Office of Research and Analysis, and we're the primary producers and analysts for the employment and unemployment statistics and labor market analysis probably seen published in Alaska Economic Trends. Probably, yes, some of you probably know I am related to Red Boucher, but I'll try not to turn this into a Freddy Krueger nightmare. I know my dad gets a turn at the mic, sometimes he doesn't let go. But definitely I won't do that. Neil and I plan to do a quick 15 to 20 minute overview of Alaska's 92 economic performance and give you an idea of what our outlook is for 93 and 94. I'll primarily focus on the statewide industry and employment trends, and then Neil will do a regional analysis and give you what our expectations are going to be for the unemployment situation and Alaska's job market for the next couple years. If I could start out by directing your attention to the first handout entitled Alaska's Job Growth Moderates, you can get a pretty good idea of where the economy was headed in 1992. Statewide, I think we characterized 92 as a year of slower employment growth. But in retrospect, I guess with all of the negative news that we had, especially in the first part of the year, you could consider that the economy might have done a little better than people would have expected, even we would have expected. First of all, I want to recap a few of the significant events that occurred in 92, which ended up pushing employment growth down. First of all, most of you are well aware of the major consolidation that went on in the oil and gas industry, which began late in 91 and continued throughout 92. If I could point your attention to the next handout, Alaska's oil industry employment in 86 to 92, you can see that we took quite a hit in oil and gas employment between 1991 and 1992. I think, though, that it is kind of important.
Senator Pierce had a quick question.
Who does this capture? Who all do we count as an oil
industry? Oil industry employment. Primarily, it's the two major producers, right, and then oil field service employees like your VCOs, Norcons, drilling companies. The majority of the loss, by the way, when you look at those two groups, was in the contractor. Then, in addition to the losses we had in the oil industry, the closure of the Anchorage Times meant the loss of about 400 jobs to the Anchorage economy. And then Alaska's timber industry continued on a path of what has been a contraction since late 1990. Those were the big negatives in Alaska's economy in 1992. I think two sectors which we categorize 92 as little or no growth would have been the construction sector and also the hard rock mining industry. Now, the sectors that offset the bad news would have been the services industries, primarily led by a strong performance in tourism and the healthcare sector. In addition to that, we had retail trade expansion in just about every major urban area in Alaska in 1992, but primarily in 92 that was concentrated in Fairbanks and Anchorage. In addition...
What kind of jobs are those? How would you characterize them in terms of those sort of jobs? Are they part-time, full-time?
Well, we know that retail trade employment generally is characterized by more lower wage and part-time employment. So the analogy I guess I could best use is that in terms of total economic impact, 100 jobs that you gain at Costco probably doesn't have the 100 jobs impact that you lose at ARCO. So seafood, three positive events we can point to that we would point as reasons for growth. We had a rebound in the crab harvests, better salmon prices, and a continued expansion in the bottom fish industry. The public sector also contributed some employment growth. Both of these sectors were primarily in education-related employment as either at the University of Alaska or in local school districts who've been responding to the increase in school-age population. That's kind of the overview for 92. I guess now I'll move on to what our best guess is for 93, 94. I think we can best characterize our outlook right now is one of fragile growth. with some potential wild cards which could either trip the economy up or assist it to some unexpected growth. First of all, I want to start out with what the positive news will most likely be. I think retail trade expansion will probably grab most of the economic headlines in Alaska in the next 2 years. We've got Kmart and Walmart ready to enter Alaska's market in full force. In addition, you've got the existing retailers looking at expanding now.
Existing retailers like
Fred Meyer, Sears, undergoing some expansion right now of existing facilities. Cars has also been on an aggressive expansion program. So, okay. In addition, we continue to expect services led by tourism and healthcare growth, but probably not quite at the pace as it did in 1992. We expect that growth to slow a little bit. One industry which we expect to turn around a little bit from no gain to some gain would be construction, with a $1.5 billion project scheduled for the North Slope in GHX2, the gas handling facility. That could be a major engine for construction employment growth statewide. Other big projects we can point to right now would be the Alaska Native Hospital in Anchorage, continuation of the Cebu Hotel at Girdwood. And of course, if we have all of this retail expansion, there'll be some commercial construction that goes along with that. That could be the commercial market in Anchorage could be booming. Well, not
very. For the construction and the GHX, too, I know that a lot of the modules themselves are coming up in the sea lift, and it's going to be the biggest sea lift I think we've had since years. So you can't, the people who actually put those things together and put the pipes in as construction jobs as opposed to wellfield service.
Well, it depends. We categorize firms based on their major business activity. Okay. And some firms, like, let's take Vico for an example, are difficult to say. Sometimes they do oilfield services or construction projects directly for the oil industry. And right now, they're categorized as an oilfield services firm. So essentially, we could see, with that project, we could see some firms who are categorized as construction right now and some who are categorized as oil field services. We kind of just have to cubbyhole them one time. And then so the growth could actually show up in either place.
Has Alyeska announced any major corrosion programs beyond that?
Not that I'm aware of. Okay. Local government, we continue to expect that the education facilities in the state will be pressured by increased enrollment. And so we kind of expect when you have more kids, sooner or later you have to add teachers. And so there's going to be pressure to add facilities and or teachers. Two industries which we'd place in the little or no change category would be state government, and by the end of 92, any growth that had appeared either at the university or on the non-education related had disappeared. Hard rock mining, I'd also place in the no growth category. Right now, it looks like the three major projects that we've got that would add major groups of employees to the mining industry, the AJ project, and Kensington project around Juneau and Fort Knox, all look to be outside of the next 2 years. We may have some construction in one or two of those facilities in 94 in the pre-development stage, but right now we're kind of counting them out. Things could turn around, but right now, I guess, counting them out. The timber industry actually looks like it might hold its own in the next 2 years, and that would be positive news simply because it would more or less have stopped the bleeding. Increasing prices of timber and recently the reopening of the Chugach sawmill are two positive signs in that.
I have a question. Senator, there's a serious pollution problem in southeastern Alaska. Right? That in any way going to affect the timber industry, both of the major plants? Mm-hmm.
I think that's going to...
You're predictable.
Right. I think right now we're looking for pulp mill employment to hold its own in the next 2 years. There has been that pressure for a long time, I think. And also, what you're looking at, too, is...
Change the administration can not enforce
it. Yes, they may enforce the regulation, but right now... We're thinking that at least the pulp mills will be able to survive the next 2 years now. I think market concerns are also a concern for those. Right now, the prices for dissolved pulp have not been that good.
We watched the cyclical.
Yes. Now, I think I'd like to end my presentation really with the wild cards, which really could end up determining the fate of the overall economy. First of all, oil and gas. 4 to 6 months ago, I certainly would have placed this industry in a continued downward spiral at least through this year. But recent developments, though, the positive response to the Cook Inlet oil sale, the new developments on the slope of Kivlin, may have changed the psychology of the industry a little bit, and so I'm not quite as negative on the industry as I was in terms of employment, as I was a while back. I think the military is certainly potential source for concern. Clinton administration may change the face of Alaska's military entirely. With probable military cuts on the horizon, you can't take any of Alaska's military facilities for granted.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
That again seems to me to be a true, reasonable analysis. If it is, then find new studies for housing, but I won't get too busy in the building at the moment. That's just about the second thing. Excuse me.
On the military from change from 91 shows a drop of 1,100. Where was that concentrated?
Primarily at Eielson Air Force Base with the relocation of the 6th Strategic Reconnaissance Wing. There was some other drop elsewhere, but that's where the biggest change was.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Truly.
Gentlemen, they were looking for housing, and they were moving from overseas and so on, too. Does that play any factor, just locating masses of people someplace? Russians would have to locate theirs back in Russia. We've got to locate our masses of troops to pull them in someplace until we muster them out. Alaska looked like one of those places that would be a temporary repository. Have you looked at that at all?
I haven't looked at it, Senator, I can tell you.
I just have a feeling that might be happening. Thank you.
At any rate, I think, continuing on the military, I think Fort Richardson has long been speculated as being a potential target for closure, and so we have to consider that in our forecast of potential. On the plus side, though, Elmendorf was designated as a site for a major military hospital, and so that, if that should go, that would lead to an expansion in Elmendorf. Then, in terms of the seafood industry, that one's a very difficult one to predict just because of the series of the runs. But right now, I think one negative factor currently is that we've got eroding salmon prices. And I think most fishermen certainly would not like to see a repeat of the prices that occurred 2 years ago. In Southwest Alaska, we're continuing to look for expansion in the bottom fish industry. And we think that'll continue to maintain some momentum. If the salmon industry can more or less hold its own, I think we can might manage to eke out some employment growth there. Overall, just wrapping up, I think we're looking at some slow, gradual growth, and with some question marks that could swing the economy either way. Now, I'll turn you over to Neil, who's going to cover the regional pictures and talk about the unemployment situation.
Good morning. I wasn't sure that I'd get to present anything this morning. I predicted that John would have the same voucher remote verboseness that they usually are, but my prediction was wrong. I hope our economic predictions are better. I'd like to touch upon sort of the regional picture of the state. The reason why I'd like to do that is that we sort of see this calmness, a broad calmness and moderate growth for the statewide picture, but I think there may be a fair amount of turbulence underneath that calmness when we look at different regions. And I'd also like to touch upon the labor force, the job market, and what kind of employment opportunities are going to exist out there for Alaskans in the next couple of years. I'd like to turn to one of our overheads, or one of our graphs here. It's the one right behind that wonderful graph, Alaskan Economics and Statehood, which gives you sort of an economic history of the state, but I'd like to go beyond that one to the one that's titled Regional Picture Mixed at Year's End, and just point out a few of the salient points that might help explain the economic picture around the state. When we look at this picture, we quickly realize that some of the state's economies, the region's economies, are in high gear. Some of them are low gear. One of them was in reverse, and one of them was actually stuck in neutral. And I'd like to start with that one, the Gulf Coast region, which was basically stuck in neutral, was basically in purgatory in 1992. And the Gulf Coast region is a very big region of the state. It includes the Kodiak area, the Kenai area. It includes the Valdez, Prince William Sound area of the state. And although it appears that the Gulf Coast region stood still in 1992, that's not a completely accurate picture because tourism grew in that sector. Fishing also expanded in the Gulf Coast region. But all those gains were lost when the Kenai Peninsula got very hard hit in the oil patch. Those losses in the oil industry and Cook Inlet were large enough to offset all the gains that occurred in other industries. We expect that to turn around a little bit. There will be a lot of planned activity in Cook Inlet for the next couple of years, and that should turn the oil patch picture around in the Gulf Coast region, and therefore we think that area of the state will move onto the positive side of the ledger. Then we move to the southwest part of the state, which looks like the star performer here, and it is. It's been the star performer for a number of years. But I want to caution you that performance is really as a result of one industry, and almost all of that growth is taking place in one place. The place that most of this growth is taking place in is, of course, the Unalaska Dutch Harbor area. The reason is the bottom fish and the crab fishery. Now, we think that this may continue, this growth may moderate some, and it could actually spread out a little bit more to some of the other communities in that area that includes the Bristol Bay area and the rest of the Aleutian Islands because of the CDQs that we are now seeing take place. It may spread some of that growth around to some of the other communities. Then if we look to the last largely rural part of the state, the northern region, you can see that basically went negative in the last year. That all those losses are a result of what happened in Prudhoe Bay. Big losses on the North Slope last year, 800 to 1,000 jobs. And that's what knocked that to that side of the graph. We think that will probably turn positive this year. Moderately so, but it'll turn positive because of the things that John talked about, the GHX2 project, and other exploration and development activity on the North Slope. If we turn to the urban areas, the more urban areas, things change a little bit. If we look at the Fairbanks interior or the Doyon region, it covers the same area. It looks like it's another one of those star performers, but I want to caution you there. A lot of the growth there came as a result of the retail trade boom. Now, when we talk about the retail trade boom, we're largely talking about the future. However, Fairbanks got sort of a head on the curve on that. They had two large new facilities opened up at the end of 1991 that really pushed these figures way ahead in 1992. There were other parts of the economy that helped push these numbers into the positive side. Tourism was a good year last year. We did have a Field of Dreams. People did come up the highway in large numbers. And that also helped boost the interior part of the state.
Can I ask you a question on
that? Yes.
It seems hard to imagine that most of the military reduction was at Eielson, if we're talking about the same period.
Yeah, we are.
That wouldn't have overshadowed any positive growth in retail and tourism.
Well, there was actually some other positive growth in the military in Fairbanks on the more of the civilian side with a new training facility, so that helped offset some of the loss in the uniformed military. I should caution you, our uniformed military numbers are now counted in these wage and salary numbers. The uniformed military are not counted in the wage and salary employment. So that is another important dynamic.
Oh, you mean they're included here?
Yes.
But they're not included here.
That's correct.
Yeah, we didn't want to overlook the military, but they aren't counted in
our. I see. Okay.
but the civilian military would be.
Okay. Senator Jacko?
What accounts for the retail trade boom? Where's the money coming from that people are spending in the retail industry?
Well, a lot of people speculate on why is this retail boom occurring. I think there are a number of reasons. One, I think it's just trend. We're going to the discounting type of retailing, and Alaska's just sort of catching up to that. A lot of this has happened elsewhere in the country. Alaska is a very good retail market. Our incomes generally tend to be higher. Our disposable income tends to be higher. So it's a good environment for retailers. I think also our economy's been relatively more healthy than the rest of the country during the last couple of years. And we're a much younger population, and like I like to tell people, young people are very often irresponsible. They like to spend lots of money, and therefore it's a good retail market. Of course, that's not true, but there's a lot of new families being formed in Alaska, and you know, that's retailers drool over that kind of those kinds of demographics. So I think there's a lot of reasons. I think a lot of them figure they're going to just take market share also. But it is sort of a curious situation. But
essentially, there's less jobs, and they're creating more retail stuff to sell. And so where's the money going to come from, I guess?
I think they figure that they are the new retailers are going to take a lot of the market share away from the older retailers. I think some of them